Welcome to the weekly broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. The Commonwealth Club is a nonpartisan public forum dedicated to airing diverse views on important topics of national interest. Today's program was made possible through the support of the members of the Commonwealth Club. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
So welcome, everyone, to this meeting of Inform, the Commonwealth Club's Innovation Lab. You can find Inform online at informsf.org. I'm Cheryl Sandberg, and I'm really excited to be here. I have the great pleasure of introducing a phenomenal woman and a great friend, Marianne Cooper. Marianne is a Stanford sociologist. She works at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research. And I first got to know who Marianne was when she wrote this article called The Other F Word. Any guesses what that word was? Feminism. And the article was about women in college who were taking a feminist studies class but didn't want anyone to call them a feminist and didn't associate with the word feminist. And Marianne brought such a sense of humor to the topic but also a seriousness with which the issue was raised. So then when I was looking for a partner to lead the research for Lean In, I met and interviewed Marianne and then had the experience of spending an entire year working together. Marianne's a pretty special combination of someone who is a deeply, deeply, you know, fantastic academic who understands research, understands methodology, understands what makes research valid and what doesn't, but also has this incredible desire to make the world a better place, to make the world more equal for women, and make the world more equal for people who don't have the same economic opportunities that they deserve. And that's the passion that comes out in this book. She's also an amazing person and just has been a great friend to me, and I know a great friend to so many people in this audience. So please join me in welcoming to Inform, Marianne Cooper. So we are here tonight to talk about Cut Adrift, Families in Insecure Times. This is Marianne's new book, just out. And it talks about families coping in insecure times. And it's actually a very intimate look at the challenges facing modern families. Our goal is to have this conversation. I'll get a chance to ask Marianne questions. Then you'll get a chance to ask Marianne questions. And really hopefully leave with a better understanding of how we understand economic insecurity that occurs to many different families in many different ways, but also what we can do as a society and as a community to address it. So I'm going to start at the very beginning. Marianne, you are interested in so many things. You are interested in economic insecurity. You are interested in the sociological underpinnings of what makes people tick. You're obviously very interested in feminism and gender. And this is a remarkable book. I, as you know, read it on a vacation with my husband where he thought maybe I would not be reading a book, but it was the galley and I couldn't put it down. It was really amazing. Marianne, what led you to write this book at this time?
I wrote it because a major part of the story of what's happening in our society was missing. So for the past few decades, we know inequality has been on the rise, insecurity has been on the rise. So we now have a hollowed out middle class, families are losing jobs, losing homes. That story is mostly told through statistics. So academics look at tax records and job reports. And what they've concluded is that right now, we have almost unprecedented levels of inequality and insecurity. By some measures, things haven't been this bad since the Great Depression. And that's a pretty dramatic conclusion. But I felt like the dramatic punch of it wasn't coming across in these statistical tables and charts that so meticulously documented. And so I felt like somebody needed to go and talk to people about how they're coping with this. Right? So underneath these hard numbers are people who live out these trends in their everyday lives. So we know more of them are experiencing insecurity. We know more of them are on their own to cope with it, but we don't know how they're coping, and we also don't understand how this growing divide between the haves and the have-nots in our society changes the way we manage and experience security and insecurity.
So let's start there. As you say, there have been long-standing trends which are leading towards economic insecurity and, you know, further income disparity, and I think income insecurity for many families. And that was all happening, and then 2008 happens and a recession happens. Why don't we start by talking about the overall economic trends? What is happening in the U.S. economy? How did the 2008 recession affect us?
So it's a big story. There are actually lots and lots of books and articles about it. But I think three of the most important things that have happened for families is the decline of middle-income jobs, what we would call the shift in risk, which I can explain, and then growing inequality. So it used to be that our economy was based on manufacturing, and today it's now based on services. So about 80% of jobs are in the service sector now. And in comparison to manufacturing jobs, service sector jobs are, they pay less, and they come with fewer benefits, and they're much more insecure. And then layered on top of this is that workers no longer have the leverage that they once did to collectively bargain for better wages and better working conditions. And that's because unions are on a steep decline. So after World War II and into the 1950s, about a third of employed people were represented by unions, and we've reached a new historical low, which is that only 11% of workers are represented by unions. And that also has another effect, which is it's not just that workers can't collectively bargain to get a better deal. It's that this has eroded a moral commitment to fair pay. So it used to be, even if you weren't in a union, unions set the wage, and other employers respected that. And that increased the wage for a lot of other people who weren't in unions. So we've got a double whammy here. And then the other thing that occurred is what is called the shift in risk. And there's really been a rewriting of the social contract between employers and employees. It used to be based on mutual loyalties and mutual protections. So that means that employers gave people good wages and good benefits, and in return, people worked really hard and used their talents to help build that company. But what's happened is that increasingly risk has been offloaded by governments and corporations onto individuals and their families. So if you think about the movement from pensions to 401ks, employers used to share risk with us, now we're really on the own to save our own money for retirement, and we're on the hook for any miscalculations that we make. So all of these things together have really gotten us to a point where the types of jobs that created a thriving middle class in this country are harder to find and harder to hold on to. So it's definitely tougher out there than it used to be. And families are really experiencing that. The question is how tough? And that really depends on where you sit in relation to all of this, because you've got all this growing insecurity and shift in risk, and then over here you have this rise in income and wealth inequality. So there are some highly educated and highly skilled workers who are actually doing really well, and they still have really good jobs. So these trends play out for different families in different ways.
So to write the book, you interviewed over 50 families over long periods of time. And what you'll find if you read the book is that the information is detailed and it's intimate. You are not just able to describe how these families are living and what are the situations, but in really deep detail how they feel, why they feel how they feel, which I know as a sociologist you taught me through the lean-in process is what we're always looking for, the reason, the why, the underlying reason. So let's start with the methodology. Why these interviews? How did you conduct these interviews? How did you get 50 families to invite you this deeply into their lives?
Well, because I wanted to understand this more personal, emotional side of it, I did interviews and ethnography. So I went out and wanted to find families, rich, middle class, and poor, and interview them about, you know, the obstacles in their life. But I wanted to add something to that. So I followed a smaller group of families around in a very in-depth way.
But like really followed them around?
Really followed them around.
Like they went here, you went here.
Yeah,
they
like went there. I ate dinner with them. I was in the car when we picked up the kids. Went to the soccer games. I really got to know them. The hardest part about doing this is recruiting the families. And because specifically, it's always hard to recruit people to be in your research. So if someone ever asks you, please say yes, because it's really, really hard.
But, and then you could have Marianne in your car when you pick up your kids,
yeah.
For example.
But what was extra hard is that I needed to know what income level someone was in. And in normal social interaction, you don't like walk up to a stranger and say, how much do you earn? Right? So I had to figure out another way of doing this, and I struggled with it for a long time. And then I met Laura Delgado, who was working as a cashier at a big box store one day when I was procrastinating starting this project. And she seemed really nice, and she solved a problem I had, which is that I knew since she was a cashier how much she probably made. And so I asked to interview her, and I interviewed her, and then she invited me along to her son's All-Star Little League tournament game. And I don't know how much any of you know about Little League, but I learned way more than I ever wanted to know. But
they're really long games.
They're really long games.
Kids Little League, it's really long.
Yes. And sometimes you're not so sad when they lose, because that means you can go home.
And the parents are dying for something to talk about.
Yes, they are. It's an interesting place. Someone should study it. So I was sitting in the stands with her, and so this is an all-star team from the working class community that her family lived in. Her son Dylan was on the team, and I'm just kind of trying to get a lay of the land. And a kid hits a foul ball, and it goes into the parking lot where the opposing team's cars are. And Laura leans over to me, and she says, "Ooh, you know, I hope a car doesn't get hit. Those are really fancy cars." And I noticed that there were like, you know, Mercedes and BMW SUVs, and I asked where this other team came from, and she said it was from a community, one of the most affluent communities we have in Silicon Valley. And I realized in that moment that what was on the baseball field before me was a miniature version of the story I was trying to tell. And so when I was, you know, I drove home with Laura, and she has this sort of aging, you know, beaten up minivan, and there's like a crack in the window, and I was saying to myself, I wonder what it's like if I were in one of those nice SUVs driving home with, you know, one of the opposing team's families. And that's when I realized that this would be a really great way to recruit families, because I could tell from the town they were from what the likely income and wealth level of that family was. So I spent the next few weeks driving around Silicon Valley, going to all these games, sitting in the stands, observing all this stuff.
So the next time you're at a baseball game for a kid and yeah. You see someone just sitting there, it might be a Stanford researcher.
Yeah.
Not another parent.
So say yes. Yeah. I got turned down a few times, but a lot of people said yes. And that formed the core of the families that I ended up working with. But from there, I started interviewing families, you know, again, 50 families, diverse set of families from rich to poor. And then once I started figuring out what the themes were, or at least what I thought were emerging, then I picked families who were representative of these trends to do in-depth fieldwork with. And this is when I followed them around and hung out with them. And so establishing rapport is an art and a science. I mean, there's a lot of books that you can read as a social scientist to understand how to establish rapport. But I think it really starts with genuinely caring about what people have to say. And so I got to know the families really, really well, and they got to know me. Technically, they had only signed up for me to spend 30 hours with them. I spent a lot more time than that with them. And I've been in contact with them since this research began. So, you know you're in when the kids start swearing in front of you, when, you know, a husband rolls his eyes at his wife in front of you. And that's when you know that you're getting backstage. So I definitely felt at first that people were on their best behavior, but over time they really let their guard down.
So you went to these 50 families, and you were looking for what kind of financial issues they were having and then the impact they have. Mm-hmm. So let's start. And I know there was a full range of families. What kind of financial issues were these families facing?
Well, all the statistics that I had been reading about really came to life, which is why I wanted to do it. So, soaring debt, bankruptcies, foreclosures, all these kinds of things I saw play out. So with Laura Delgado, for example, her family is really dealing with massive debt. And what their issue was, you know, she worked as a cashier when I met her, but she was actually in the middle of separating from her husband, and her husband had dealt with long-term unemployment. But their family was actually sort of almost a historical case study of this shift in risk, because about 10 years before I met her, her husband had worked for a company that didn't offer health insurance, and so they went without it. And sadly, the worst happened, which is that she had a seizure while she was driving her car and hit a parked car. And unfortunately, no one else was hurt, but she suffered severe internal injuries, and she was in an intensive care unit for about a week. And when she got out of the hospital, she was $50,000 in debt for the medical bills. And for a family that was really just getting by to begin with, this was too much for them to bear. And in the book, it plays out that this was just the beginning of a series of economic hits. And then I saw families dealing with declines in pay. So in the book, I talk about a family, the Califatos, and Gina Califato, who's a college graduate, working as an account manager for a technology company, but the technology company started to falter. And so they instituted pay cut after, you know, furlough after pay cut. And so I saw her in the wake of this really trying to figure out how to pay the bills without running up debt on her credit card. And she actually illustrates something that's also important, which is that insecurity is moving up the class ladder. And it's actually moving into, you know, among people that we would expect to have a secure life, like college graduates. And what the data shows is that by 2001, when a college graduate lost their job, their earnings often went down by as much as 23% in their next job. So I saw her as on the front lines of that. And then there were the affluent families. Those were not the statistics I was seeing. They have much more secure jobs. They were not dealing with pay decreases. But they were still worried, which we'll talk about. But so, you know, think about, just hold in your mind, this is the field work I'm doing. I've got Laura Delgado here, I've got Gina Califato here. And then I interview this woman, Kate Casper. She and her husband both have MBAs. Their income is like $450,000, and we're talking. And I'm talking about college, and she's like, oh, we don't have enough savings set aside for college yet. I'm like, oh, really? How much do you have? She's like, $140,000. And I was like, okay, so tell me about that. And really the issue was she felt like it was part of her parental obligation that she and her husband sent their kids to college and pay for it. And, you know, she could have said, go to a community college. She could have said, you guys pay for it for yourself. But she really felt like this was her responsibility. And so that's why she felt behind. And I began to see that even for people who have a lot of resources, there's a lot of anxiety going on. So really what I found is that families have to do what I call security work or worry work to fill this gap between what they earn and what they need. Families have always done security work for, you know, in just daily economic life, but there's a historical context to the kind of security work that we have to do. And right now in this era, this task of managing insecurity has become, I would say, harder and more unpredictable for a larger number of families.
So let's talk about those financial challenges and the security work the families are doing. Going from Laura Delgado to the family that's, you know, earning a lot, making them very wealthy, what were the types of insecurities these families were facing, and what were the strategies they were using to deal with them?
Well, what's important to understand is that people respond to insecurity both practically and emotionally. And this is the real contribution of my book, I think. So as this job of creating security has been transferred onto all of us and our families, people across different social classes not only do different things. So affluent families make contributions to their 401ks, and people like Laura Delgado go without health insurance. But they also rely on different emotional coping mechanisms to get by. This is a part of the story that it took me a long time to figure out what I was hearing. And I was out one day doing something called exercise. This was before I had children, a long time ago. And I heard this story that really helped clarify or crystallize what it was that I was struggling with. And it was a story about a man named Timothy Bowers. And he was 62 years old, and he had been laid off from his job that he was like a driver for a drug manufacturer. And after 3 years of barely getting by, he came up with a plan to get by until he was old enough to receive his full Social Security benefits. So he went down to a local bank, and he handed a teller a stick-up note for $80. And then he turned the money over to the security guard and waited for the police to arrive and arrest him. And at his trial, he told the judge that a 3-year sentence at a minimum security prison would, quote, suit him fine, because upon his release from prison, he would be old enough to receive his full Social Security benefits. The New York Times described him as an honest-to-goodness visionary in the realm of retirement planning. Right? But his lawyers actually saw what he did differently. And his lawyer said, you know, after struggling to find a job with benefits, he finally said, to hell with it. So at his hearing, which is near his 63rd birthday, you know, the judge handed him down this sentence and said, you know, it's a pretty sad day when someone feels that this is their only alternative. And then she said, I'm going to give you a birthday present. And she gave him exactly what he wanted, right, which is a 3-year jail term at a minimum security prison. And I just stood on the side of the road for a while, and I was like, how does someone come to feel that going to jail is the perfect birthday gift? How is it that he could work on his emotions enough, or that his situation was so bad that this became an idea where he was like, I'm going to do it. This is a really a good way to go. He was talking himself into something because this is the reality he had to cope with. And that's what led me to understand that families are really coping with insecurity, not just by what they do, but also by what they feel and how they manage their feelings within all of this. So we're actually kind of doing security, right? We're doing it with our head, and we're also doing it with our heart.
Talk a little bit about some of the specific security work. So from the Delgados to some of the wealthier families, the specific ways of sharing, share with us some of the specific ways of why they felt insecure, what they felt insecure about. Yeah. I think one of the most interesting things I found in the book is reference points matter a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you and I talked about this a lot for Lean In.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of what happens in the workforce is reference points. People have expectations of what gender can be, and therefore they put those on, and those create assumptions that women fight very hard against, you know, men are trapped in those as well. There's a lot in your book about reference points and expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about those from the different families?
Yeah, so to start with, though, from talking with families from rich to poor, what I realized is that we're all weighed down by something very similar, which is the anxiety generated by hard times. So from technology executives to domestic workers, everyone feels insecure. They're just feeling it and dealing with it differently. And what I found among affluent families is they want more and more and more. In response to all this insecurity, that's the way they're responding. And middle class and working class families are really trying to get themselves to be okay with less. So I talked to Paul Ma, and despite having assets that were over $1 million, he told me that he didn't feel totally financially secure. So he said to me, you know, I know I'm in the top 1%, but I still don't feel rich. So with millions more for him to accumulate before he could relax, I came out of my interview with him, and I was like, you know. And then on the other hand, you have Laura Delgado, who in many ways, you know, she's a cashier in the middle of this separation with her husband, you know, $50,000 in debt, who in many ways is less worried than Paul Ma. And that's because unlike Paul, she's actually stopped hoping for more. She has kind of scaled back her definition of security to really just the basics, food, shelter, and clothing. And she also filters out the bad news by only focusing on the positive. So she would say to her kids a lot of the time, you know, don't whine and complain. Don't throw yourself a pity party. You know, focus on the positive and move forward. One time she said to me, you know, having nothing isn't always a bad thing. And I was like, really? So what I realized is that, and this was kind of a common thing that I was finding among struggling middle class and working class families, is that they were trying to make the insecurity that they faced more tolerable. Right? So and one time, Laura, she couldn't keep up with paying the electricity bill, so the heat got turned off. And she said to me, but it's okay, it's like we're camping. Right? So she took what really is a symbol of insecurity, right? The lack of heat, and repackaged it as a symbol of security, like family bonding. So affluent families, though, moved in the opposite direction, which is instead of trying to accommodate themselves to greater insecurity, they were going to build an economic firewall that protected their family from it. And so that's where you get this wanting more and more and more. And they were particularly concerned about their children. I don't know how many times I heard about, you know, India and China are on the rise, and our kids no longer have a competitive advantage just being, you know, being from the United States. So to address this, one father said, so I took my son with me on a business trip to China so he could see how hard people in Asia work, like so that their kids could really see like what was coming. Another family took their daughters on a tour of a call center in India to understand the forces of globalization. And that mother said to them, if you don't have a skill set that's unique or a knowledge set that's unique, your job's going to end up in another country, which is probably terrifying to hear when you're 10, right? These families, there was a lot of, I mean, I hope I'm conveying it, but there was a lot of real anxiety. And among the wealthiest families I talked to, they needed a net worth north of $10 million before they felt really financially secure. And so all of this is to say that the dividing lines among us are not just economic, they're also emotional, right, in terms of how we're defining security.
You're listening to a broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California. Become a member of the Commonwealth Club and support the club and its radio broadcast by visiting www.commonwealthclub.org.
And one of the things your book brings out is that there are a lot of these coping mechanisms and the sociology behind how people are experiencing this, which is actually exacerbating the inequality that starts this circle. So it really is a self-reinforcing cycle that there's increasing income disparity. There's increasing economic insecurity, actually, wherever you are in the economic spectrum. And then there are behaviors which come out of that, which reinforce that trend, which create more insecurity and more disparity. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah. So it's like we know inequality is growing, and most of us think it's bad. So why are we complicit in it? Right? And I think from this research, what I realize is because we're all just head down, right? We're focused on our own situation. And what that leads to is responses like Laura Delgado's, right, where she kind of talks herself through this anxiety. And in doing that, she's actually compensating for the very inequality that created the hardship she has to endure, right? And so she's talking herself through this. She's working on her feelings. And what this ends up doing is preventing her from taking a critical stance towards the system that she's in, right? Instead of saying, I can't believe that I don't have health care, and so as a result of that, I'm $50,000 in debt, she blames herself and is like, I think I should just try to save more, right? So you have that response on one hand. And then on the other hand, you have Paul Ma, who's not satisfied with what he has, and he's pushing for more because he wants to insulate his children from this. He wants to position them against a world that he sees as increasingly insecure. So you have Laura pulling one way and Paul pulling another. So they're exacerbating this problem. So in response to all this insecurity, what's happening is that the rich don't think they have enough and they're striving for more. And everybody else realizes that they can't do much about their situation. So they're lowering their expectations and trying to get used to less. So we actually make inequality worse. And then because we're all kind of busy treading water in our, you know, by coping in our own separate ponds, we actually fail to come together with the collective will to stop this.
One of the things, there were great examples in your book, were about the role religion plays. And I think one of the central theses of your book is that there isn't the safety net there used to be. As you discussed in the beginning, there isn't the safety net provided by collective bargaining. There isn't the safety net provided by long-term employers. You know, in our father's generation, people went to work for one company and they often stayed their whole lives. That doesn't happen very frequently anymore. And there isn't the government safety net that past generations had. And so as a result, that safety net's not there and people look elsewhere. And one of the most, I think, optimistic things in this book is the role religion plays. That the communities that some religions are enabled to facilitate to really be that safety net for people.
Yeah. So there are a lot of religious families, you know, from top to bottom that I talked to. But the ones that really for security focused on religion were working class and poor families that were in real economic trouble. And they turn to their churches for social support, so, you know, food and shelter and clothing. But they also relied on their faith for what I would say is psychological comfort. So their belief that God provides, that God has a plan for them, that God rewards the faithful with material blessings provided a lot of comfort in what are really, really difficult circumstances. And so this story is told through the Falau family. They're an immigrant family from Samoa. And Lieta, the mother, who worked as a domestic worker, would often say to me, you know, I don't know how I'd make it without the church. And the church gave them diapers when they needed it for their kids. And several times when they were short on their rent, the church provided some money. And she would always say, you know, the Lord has a plan for me. When she would get really, really stressed out, she would pray that the Lord would find a way for her. And so when that happened, like when a friend of hers, like, brought some food during a week that was really tight and they didn't have enough money to buy food, she interpreted that as God looking out for them. Now, what's interesting is I never had someone at the top say, you know, my 401k went up by 20% last year. God's really blessing me. So God works in different ways for different people. It was a remarkable thing to see this church community really rallying behind this family. But this actually gets back to the point about the shift in risk, which is that welfare provision has increasingly gone and been outsourced from the federal government out to the states and then out to faith-based organizations. And the evidence is really inconsistent about whether or not this is actually the best approach. But the problem that I think this creates is that oftentimes, and as safety nets have been rolled up, churches are the only place for people to turn, which creates a context where people might feel like they need to say things or believe things that they don't necessarily believe. And I don't think this should be the only place where families can turn. Right? These support systems, we need to create new institutions that address these new realities so that this isn't the only haven in a heartless world.
And what was interesting about some of those havens, and you told the story through this family, through the immigrant family, were that they were both the givers and receivers of that safety net from each other. There were periods at points in time where they needed extra money for rent, they needed food, they needed basic needs that they otherwise could have lost their home, and the church provided that. But then one of the things that kept them from saving and building up a safety net is that in the times when they had a little bit extra, they would give back to their community.
Yes. Yeah.
And there was, a pretty strong sense of those people not being alone. Mm-hmm. Which I think very optimistic. Yeah. And it's a perfect segue because we are a country of immigrants. Mm-hmm. You know, all of our families, every single one of us, at some point in time, our families immigrated here and we came here for better lives. Mm-hmm. And that's the American dream. The American dream is you leave wherever you come from, you come here, you work hard, you get an education, and the next generation is better off than yours. And that was certainly the American dream of this family. It was certainly the American dream of my great-grandparents who came here, and I think, you know, all of ours. What's happening? What's happening to the American dream?
I think it's just a dream. The American dream has long been equated with moving up the class ladder and owning a home. And for that to happen, people have to actually think those goals are attainable. But what I found was that people had let go of their dreams because something outside of their control, like a layoff or an uninsured medical emergency, had come along and just blown it for them. And so in that context, you know, having a long-term goal is not only pointless, it's painful, right? You're literally setting yourself up for disappointment. So I think people are, instead of, you know, looking up and thinking about their dreams, their head down, trying to just protect themselves in this environment. You know, people used to think that working hard would translate into moving up, and I think that's really fallen by the wayside. And we're starting to see some interesting changes in surveys about the American dream. So people are much more focused now on holding on to what they have than they are with moving up. And other surveys are finding that the desire to own a home has been replaced by a desire to be debt-free and a desire for financial stability. And all of this makes sense. These are perfectly rational responses to this historical moment. But An insecure society has a huge personal and societal cost, right? It really limits people's ability to dream. And I think that's the moment we're in.
So obviously economic growth and an economy that's growing and in an inclusive way is one of the answers. What are some of the others? What are the public policy solutions? What should businesses be doing? What should individuals be doing? Mm-hmm. How do we, if the American dream has become just a dream, and I don't think that's a place any of us want to live, mm-hmm. how do we, you know, restart, reinvigorate the American dream? Make it more American and less dream.
I think to deal with the fact that we're pulling apart, we have to pull together. And part of doing that is realizing that it does not have to be this way. And so when people experience insecurity, they often experience it like a personal failure, like they've done something wrong. The reality is that they didn't do anything wrong. Policy has failed them. And policy has ushered in this age of insecurity, and I think policy is one of the only things that is going to get us out. And I think this is really a conversation about morals and values. And I think we have to have some standards in our country. Like, if you work full-time, you should not live in poverty, period.
And if I can add, it wasn't one of the examples in your book, but it's such a pertinent one. If you serve our country in uniform, you shouldn't live in poverty.
No.
If you're a teacher in our schools, if you are someone who's providing emergency services and risking your life to fight fires, police, these people who are doing these jobs, which are so important to all of us, again, you go back to people in uniform, living below the poverty line, not able to support their families,
it's un-American.
Something that is in a society we should not tolerate.
Yeah, it's un-American. And so is the idea that if someone gets in a car accident, that after that they should be under so much medical debt that it destroys them financially. Because that doesn't just affect them, that affects their kids. Right? So I think we need to return to the values that led to policies that created a middle class in our country. And just to be very clear about this, we've only had one time in our society where we've had a thriving middle class. Just one. And so it was programs that were based on these values, that we are much better off when we stand together. We are much better off when we provide security to one another in both good times and bad. Right? Standing alone doesn't get anyone anywhere. So those are the kinds of policies I think we need to return to. And, you know, it's a laundry list that you kind of hear. You know, we need living wages. We need affordable child care. We need affordable health care. We need affordable college educations. And people will say it's too expensive to have all those things. And I will tell you it's too expensive not to.
And to add to the list, education, equal education. No matter where you're from in this country, you should be able to, if you go to school, and you should be able to go to school, learn and read and write and in a way that prepares you to have these things. And as a society, I do think we have... We are turning our back too quickly and too often and losing ourselves in the weeds of an education debate and not staying focused on the fact that we know as a society an enormous percentage of our children do not get what would be a standard education almost anywhere else in the world. And it's something we need to fix.
We're throwing away our natural resources. That's essentially what we're doing. And I will also say that when you have such inequality among schools, this is what, you know, one of the reasons that families are in so much debt is they're taking on these big mortgages. People take on big mortgages for a few reasons, but one of the main ones for families is to get into a good school district, right? They're literally like mortgaging their family's future to get their kid because they know how important it is, right? Well, if we had better schools across
everywhere,
the board, we would reduce that desire, and it's an understandable desire.
That's right.
But it really puts families on the edge.
So you and I are both very passionate about inequality and opportunity, and we're very passionate about women. Mm. And one thing that runs clear in this book, which runs clear in all the research we did for Lean In, is that women are increasingly important in breadwinning in their families. Women still bear an enormous percentage of the homework, housework, and childcare, no matter what they're doing in terms of the workforce. And so women are really facing an unbelievably large part mm-hmm. of this pressure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially for middle class and working class families. So, you know, for these types of families, dealing with insecurity has sort of become just commonplace. So there are all these families, they're dealing with layoffs or declines in pay. And when I would interview these families, though, I would interview husbands and wives, I get these his versions and her versions.
That doesn't happen in anyone else's house here, right? There's only one version, yeah.
Or like my family, where there's his version, her version, and the sociological version.
Right.
Yeah. So Gina Califato is an interesting one. Again, she was dealing with her pay going down. She's scrambling to deal with it. And this was, you know, I interviewed her, and she was very stressed out about all of this. And she was talking about how it was one of the worst times in her life. And it led to her having insomnia. So the day I interviewed her, she had been awake since 3 a.m. that morning. And so then I went to interview her husband, Sam, and I expected him to kind of have that same reaction, and he was pretty lighthearted. He's like, yeah, it was hard, but you know, we just didn't go out to dinner, and we just cut back here and there, and I'm like, this is really interesting. And then I kept finding the same pattern. And so, you know, the wife would say, I really wish he would worry more. And the husband would say, she's so good at doing it, she should do it.
The worrying.
The worrying. And the managing of the household finances and all that. So what I came to see is in these families, the women played the role of what I call the designated worrier. Now, the designated worrier is the person in the
family. Or maybe not even designated.
Well,
they just made themselves designated,
like,
right.
Their husbands are like, you're so awesome, you do it. You know, it's so they functioned as the security guard for their family. And the issue is that, as you said, women are doing the first shift. They're going to work. They're doing more of the second shift, which is childcare and house care. And I also realized they're doing more of what I call the insecurity shift.
The third shift, the nights of worrying.
Right, the nights of worrying. And this is a type of work that is becoming more common in families. As families increasingly experience destabilizing events, more of them are having these moments where they really have to react and grapple with all of it. And what this is linked to is actually the improving situation of educated women and the declining situation of less educated men. All of these women, what they had in common is that they were married to men who only had a high school degree and not a college degree. And so they out-earned their husbands a lot of the time, or they had more education. So as insecurity moves up the class ladder into middle-class families, when insecurity strikes, increasingly it's a woman who's best positioned to deal with it. And this created a lot of stress and conflict in these marriages. But other research is finding this as well, that you know it is women who figure out when to file for bankruptcy. It's women who deal with foreclosure notices. It's women who negotiate with bill collectors. And they're dealing with the stress and depression related to it. I mean, I heard a lot of women say, you know, I'm on antidepressants. I'm drinking too much. Or in Gina's case, you know, she wasn't sleeping at night, and later she was diagnosed with clinical depression. This is, as you say, this is the direction that our family forms are headed in. So a real problem for women.
So we're going to turn now to the audience participation. For our radio audience, reminder that this program is presented by the Commonwealth Clubs Inform. I'm Cheryl Sandberg, and we're here with Marianne Cooper, author of Cut Adrift, Families in Insecure Times.
Okay.
Your question.
Yeah. Hi, Marianne. Hi, Cheryl. Great to be here. My name is Roxanne. My question is about thinking about practical solutions for the financial insecurity, especially that the middle class and the lower class face. I was wondering about your opinion of like the sharing economy. So with companies like Uber, Airbnb, TaskRabbit, people can use their existing resources to help supplement their income, and sometimes actually really substantially with, you know, Uber and Lyft, they can make quite a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you think that that's could be a solution that will actually have an effect, or if it's not that enough.
Well, I think it's having a positive effect. I was talking to an Uber driver in New York City a few weeks ago, and he was talking about how much his earnings had increased. I mean,
yeah.
Really, really substantially, like by thousands of dollars each month, and it was
right.
Changing his life. So I think you're right. I think this model might be onto something.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the issues that families are grappling with, it's not one thing. Right? It's everything together. Because it doesn't matter if he's earning more money if he doesn't have health insurance in a certain sense, if he gets in a car accident. right? Like, he might have a little bit more savings, but it's not going to be the $50,000 he needs. Mm-hmm. So that's what we need to be thinking about, is what kind of solid foundation that we can give families to create economic security, because that foundation is what's going to lead to economic opportunity.
Hi, my name's Julia. Speaking of kind of the gender imbalance in the workforce, I've noticed a lot of retribution that comes from trying to speak out against that. What do you think we can do to remove the stigma from kind of coming out as a feminist, especially as a teenager?
I've never been worried about it. I tell you. I think you need to be on the right side of history. And when you realize what feminism actually is, I think everyone should call themselves a feminist.
And I think it's a little, it goes to Marianne's point in this book, that I think one of the main points of this book, which is, again, so beautifully written and so well documented and researched, is that insecurity is affecting all of us. No one is escaping, or very few people are escaping these insecure times, and it's creating the problems we seek to solve in the ways Marianne explained, that the insecurity is keeping people who could be, you know, understanding and feeling more giving to other groups. They're feeling nervous, so they're building financial moats around them versus other people are giving up their hopes and dreams. It's the same thing with gender inequality. You know, Marianne and I talked about with Lean In the tyranny of low expectations. That we think it's a big issue when women took over the Senate. Women won 20% of the seats in the Senate, and all the headlines said, "Women take over the Senate." And you're like, no, 20%, not a takeover. If men. But let's reverse that. If men won 20% of the seats in the takeover, someone write the headlines for me. Is that men taking over the Senate? And so expectations are so big here. And I think we should expect that we are feminists, men and women, because it's better for all of us. And so to Marianne's point on economic insecurity, all of us coming together, all of us providing more of a safety net for everyone is beneficial for the whole society. All of us, men and women, coming together on gender inequality is better for everyone. So, you know, the answer is, I'm a feminist, and you should be too.
I definitely am.
Because it's better for you.
Thank you.
Hi, Marianne. Hi, Cheryl. Thank you so much for the terrific and insightful research you shared, and Cheryl for facilitating that. You talked about the importance of us standing closer together, and I wholeheartedly agree. I wanted to know, if we fast forward 30 years' time, how optimistic you are that we will be standing closer together, and why?
Well, I'm optimistic because inequality is something that is people are starting to talk about more. And I really believe that the first step is, it's like, we have to admit we have a problem. And then we need to create our 12-step plan to get through it. So I think I'm optimistic because I think we realize we have a problem. And I think even business leaders are starting to realize, if we don't have a strong middle class, we can't sell stuff. And that's bad news for a consumer-driven economy. So, I'm a sociologist, so we're a depressing lot. Like, I don't ever get like super optimistic about things, but
sometimes she. You can get her there. Sometimes she does.
I mean, have I ever sent you something optimistic? I doubt it. Probably not.
Sometimes.
No.
Sometimes. Well, wait. No. I think you get optimistic about understanding. So when you get most optimistic is when there's a problem out there that people aren't understanding or aren't understanding the root of. Because you believe, and I think you taught me, that if you can understand the root of something, you can change it.
Yes. I do believe that. Yeah. So I'm as optimistic as a sociologist can be.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, my name is Julie. I'm a rising second year at the University of Chicago. One point that you discussed was the rising cost of colleges, which is really a hot-button issue amongst my generation. Mm-hmm. Now, there was recently an article in the New York Times about this, how colleges, they're still very much an arena for the elite because they're so expensive. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the cost of college should decrease, but it's only rising every year. Mm-hmm. Do you think that college plays a role in this cycle of inequality between elites continuing to send their children to these top schools? Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned that you think that a solution is feasible. And do you think that colleges will remain very much in a place for the elite?
Yeah, I mean, it's a key central problem in all of this, right? If you have a group of kids whose parents position them, you know, spend their entire lives positioning them to get into these elite schools and then pay for all of it, and then you have other kids who can't even pay their tuition at community colleges, this is exacerbating this problem, and it hurts us as a country. I mean, actually, the rates of middle-class students and working-class students enrolling and graduating from college has gone down. It's like the exact opposite of what we want. I think this is a huge problem, and it's a really complicated answer. But one of the main things that created a middle class in our country is the GI Bill. And the GI Bill not only paid for the education, it also paid for money to support the dependents of the veterans. Right? So we had all, that's what created this middle class. All, you know, we had millions of people going to college. So it's some kind of program like that, probably innovative in different ways. Maybe college can be less than 4 years. Maybe we can have people have, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about trade schools and vocational tracks, but things that provide people with the skills that they need. It's definitely part of the story.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Isabella, I'm 12. I have a question for Ms. Sandberg. I was listening to the NPR, and there was...
Another round of applause. I mean, see, now that's not optimistic, what is?
Yeah, it's true.
And it was, you were basically talking about how when boys are bossy, they're considered leaders.
They're not bossy, right? They're leaders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But when girls are bossy, they're considered the foul B word. So, I mean, people say I'm a bossy person, so that's really common.
Wait, another round of applause.
And I was just curious, when you were breaking the barriers, were you ever looked down upon because of your gender?
Yes. So Mary and I did all this research together, and I'll turn it over to her. But the point is that we have, again, different expectations, and expectations are so important. And when boys lead, they're called leaders, and when girls lead, they're called bossy. And what that is communicating is we don't want girls to lead. And that is cutting off opportunity. The same way economic insecurity and inequality cuts off opportunity, so do these really hard, really, really deeply, deeply felt gender stereotypes. The good news is that, again, with Marianne's help and Marianne's research, we can understand it and we can change it. And if there's anything we all could think is optimistic, it is someone who's 12, getting up to this mic after watching NPR, who is being told not that she's bossy, but that she has executive leadership skills. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Andrew Bose. I'm a tech entrepreneur, so go Facebook. Mm-hmm. I really want to dig into the observations that you made, getting to see such a wide cross-spectrum of families and people. So you made an observation that the folks on the lower end of the spectrum were a little bit more sort of accepting and sort of made the best of their situation, whereas the folks that were at the upper end were sort of paranoid and wanted more to buffer things. Do you think that, so, you know, I know a few people that are on all ends of the spectrum as well, and the people that are sort of more middle class are much more chill and happy and often pleasant to be around, and those that are, you know, climbing, you know, are, have this sort of productive paranoia, go, 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 they want to do everything all at once. In your observation, do you think there are core personality traits that these folks maybe had since they were five? Or do you think that it's sort of a result of events? Or what do you think sort of leads to all this?
I don't think sociologists really believe in personality, right? In the sense that, like, that's what leads to outcomes. It's all structural. It's all the forces that come upon us. And that we are actually creating... we create ways of acting in our children. So, for example... I had gone to this middle school graduation in an affluent neighborhood in Silicon Valley, and they'd asked the children to create like your future trajectory. And they were all on the wall at this graduation, and I ran over and I was like, my sociological senses like lit up. Because on these things in front of me were like, they're, you know, where they're going to go to high school, where they're going to go to college, where they're going to go to graduate school, what they're going to do in their life, and then they're going to retire. They had a clearer map of the educational system in our country at, you know, 10 or 11 than most other Americans do. So it's because of the opportunities that those kids have and the role models that they have and the things that they're being asked to do in class. All of that shapes who you are as a person and what your traits are. And in a world that you have control over, it's really easy to be a go-getter. You know, when you have all the resources and your parents can pay for your private school tuition, it's like not that hard in a certain sense, right? So I don't believe that the personality traits are what are leading these families down different roads. I think it's the opportunities that they have and the conditions and the choices that are presented to them.
Cool. Thank you.
You get our very last question.
I hope you find it to be a good one. Okay, in trying to explain the rise in insecurity over the last 25, 30, 35 years, the increase in healthcare costs has been talked about a lot. But in my line of work, I'm in supplemental education services. What I see is that parents spend a tremendous amount of money on supplemental education services, private schooling, or in just moving to neighborhoods with better schools. So what I'd like to know is, based on your research, how significant has there been an increase in an amount of money that parents spend on pre-college education, and how significant is it? Because my observations suggest that it is.
Yeah, it's there's a fair amount of research documenting that people are spending more on enrichment activities for children.
Right.
And the issue is that, you know, some families have more resources to spend than others. So there's actually the gap when we see educational like readiness or ability. There's a growing class gap. So the racial gap is actually getting smaller, but the gap between rich kids and even middle class kids is already being seen when they enter kindergarten. And it's precisely because of affluent families' ability to send their kid to, you know, Lego camp and robot camp, although I would encourage more of you to send your girls to those camps. But it's exactly that kind of opportunity that it gives children an edge when they get to kindergarten.
Thank you. And it was a great last question. So in the informed tradition, all speakers are asked, Marianne, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
I think what would really change the world is if people came to see that their individual personal experiences are reflections of much larger forces. I think most of the time, especially in the United States, when people experience insecurity and inequality, they experience it as like a personal problem that they individually need to fix, rather than a social problem that needs to be solved together. So if we could achieve this fundamental shift in outlook, so that people didn't think that where they ended up was solely or just from their own actions, but actually was so heavily influenced by all the social forces that are around them, that would change the world. Because that would lead people to demand policies that provide security for families. And if we did that, I think we could all worry less and dream more.
And with that, and a huge, huge applause and congratulations for such important work to Marianne, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Inforum is adjourned. Thank you.
You've been listening to the weekly broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. Today's program was made possible by the support of the members of the Commonwealth Club. The Commonwealth Club is a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum dedicated to airing diverse viewpoints on important topics. If you'd like to become a member of the Commonwealth Club or purchase a CD of this program, visit www.commonwealthclub.org. Also, stay in touch with us online at Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Please join us again next week for another outstanding program from the Commonwealth Club of California.